The worst advice, I guess, would probably be, I guess floss every day, because I really feel like that's a waste of time.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beats with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is an Emmy Award-winning comedian who has been a writer for The Daily Show for both Jon Stewart and Trevor Noah since 2013. To put that in context, when he joined the show, Obama was just beginning his second term in office, having just beaten Mitt Romney, David Cameron had just started floating the idea of an EU referendum, and Vine was just kicking off. So he's had quite a bit of news to satirize. He's also written for The Onion and Hasan Minhaj's barnstorming White House Correspondents' Dinner, toured with both John Oliver and Bo Burnham, and at the end of 2019 released his excellent debut stand-up album, Who's My Little Guy? If you haven't listened to it yet, do so immediately. Recorded on the 7th of May 2020, we chatted straight after he finished a day of writing for The Daily Show about the day's top stories, writing late night in a pandemic, the importance of Monty Python, the surprisingly high-octane plot of Goodnight Moon, and much, much more. It was also the first interview we've had that actually spanned 2 days due to the New York-UK time difference. So please welcome my guest for this week, ladies and gentlemen, Matt Coff. Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yes, thank you for having me, Dan.
So we're recording this on May 7th, 2020. You've just finished a day at work at The Daily Show. What were the biggest stories today, and how did you approach them as a writer?
Oh, wow. It's funny. As soon as I finish writing, my brain totally goes blank. I flush it out and make room for the next day's story. But, you know, as for the past 51 days, I think it's been COVID. And today we've been covering how colleges are dealing with COVID and like how people are graduating when they're not actually at the ceremony, and some people in Japan are making avatars in Animal Crossing and virtually giving each other, you know, fish instead of diplomas. So it's, you know, basically we kind of just break down the news, and like, you know, it's like so we have COVID, which is this giant topic. So lately what we've been doing is just kind of breaking it down and sort of focusing on a specific aspect each time. Mm-hmm. So it's like we're doing college now, and I think we did like high school, like we did like food inspection and like how, you know, they were dumping out like 900 gallons of beer like someplace because there was too much beer, which is I couldn't find a way to make jokes about that. That was too tragic for me.
A travesty.
Yeah. Yes. It's really just kind of, you know, separating the elements of the stories and covering it, you know, just kind of making jokes off of like each individual fact, you know.
Sure. So how has it changed writing over Zoom as opposed to being in a physical writer's room?
Well, I think it affects everyone differently, but I really enjoy it. most of the writing isn't actually over Zoom. It's over a program we call Scripto, which is kind of like a Google Documents that was kind of engineered for late night TV writing. Like somebody, Ed Colbert, like a writer who is also, I guess, a programmer, like some genius. And his name, I believe, is Rob Dubin, who designed the program. So we basically, the producers will kind of put together a general gist of what the show is going to be about and kind of give us sort of like joke prompts, like, you know, for example, oh, they're dumping out 900 gallons of beer at this place in Texas. And, you know, give us some punchlines based off that, you know. Whether it's like, oh, the rats are going to, it's craft beer, so the hipster rats are going to drink it up. And, you know, I had a joke about there being like the rats dressing in lederhosen because Oktoberfest is coming early in the sewer. But yeah, so basically it's sort of like, it's weird. I mean, there's no meeting. Like we used to have like a meeting, like a morning meeting. And now it's just kind of like, we just sit, like I just sit in my bedroom and I wait for the joke prompt, and then I just kind of write my ass off. I just write as fast as possible. And, you know, everybody else is just writing in the same document, so you just kind of have to, like, you know, go fast so that you can think of, you know, that somebody else doesn't think of your joke first.
Yeah,
so, you know, but it's kind of intense, but the day is kind of over sooner, and I have to admit, I just like I don't know, like I love my coworkers, and you know, I love the whole office, but there is something nice about not having to commute and just kind of hang out with my cat and my wife while I just you know, write.
Oh, totally. It sounds like the perfect setup.
Yeah, I mean, if it weren't for all the death and devastation happening, it would be true. Things would be great.
I mean, that is that's a fly in the ointment for sure.
But, yeah.
also insightful that you mentioned your cat before your wife. We don't have to talk therapy about this. But
well, you know, we kind of had a thing before my wife came along, and you know, I'm not going to say my wife is a third wheel, but
the other woman.
Yeah. My cat actually doesn't know about my wife yet. I haven't really broken it to her. yeah, but I don't know. That's a separate podcast, I guess.
it seems to be a lot of secrets and whistleblowing is happening over podcasts. It's good of you to get on board with that trend.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an important medium.
It truly is. So you mentioned about how it's a competitive, adrenalized effort to get to the punchline before someone else types it ahead of you. Is there a sort of a competitive edge in, well, first of all, is there a physical writer's room at the Daily Show headquarters, the studio, where you all sort of sit around the edge and pitch jokes in person? And is there the same competitive atmosphere there, or sort of friendly competitive, I don't want it seeming aggressively so, but that you're finding online?
Oh, I mean, yeah, when I say like compete, I honestly, like, it's not like it's not, I mean, I guess there is going to be in any place some sort of a little bit of built-in competition, but generally there, you know, the culture, as long as I've been here like almost like 7 years, and it's like It's been a long time, and like it's really like not, you know, it's not a kind of thing where it's like, oh, if you get the least amount of jokes on the show today, you're screwed. You know, it's not like anything like that. Like, you know, generally people try to help each other, you know, just be funny, you know. So, but when I say racing to get to the joke, I just like, basically, the worst thing that happens is, like, if somebody thinks of a joke before I do, then I just have to spend 2 or 3 more minutes thinking of just, like, another angle. It just becomes, like, a little bit more work for me, but it's not like, oh, fuck, you know, this guy's gonna get my seat at the table, you know.
4 hours
but
wasted.
What?
4 hours wasted.
Yeah, I know. That's the big problem, is that it takes me 4 hours to think of a joke, which is, I don't know why. I might not still work there. I might just kind of write on some sort of unpaid internship. I don't know. But to answer your question about the writer's room, there's like no, I mean, we do kind of have like a writer's lounge, but we, you know, a lot of the work, most of the work gets done like, you know, we're paired up in offices. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of like a writer's wing, like a hallway you go down, and it's noticeably different from the rest of the building with the rest of the staff, because it's less friendly and more introverted. And, you know, there's in the writer's wing, obviously, there's a lot more weirdos who may not look you in the eye when you say hello. That's the difference between the writers and everyone else.
It's good to have that such a visible distinction between the.
It's true, yeah. It's you know, it's like we're basically a bunch of troglodytes, I would say. I'm being diplomatic.
It's going to be, they may be listening to this.
They know it's true.
Well, how does it work then with, because it seems as though the majority of Late Night, the writers come up with a monologue, and then that gets given to the host to deliver. But with The Daily Show, it seems unique, if not differentiated because of it, with correspondents. How does it work with writing with the correspondents? How do they fit with the writing process? And at what point does a desk bit become a desk bit? When, of course, it was the time when you could sit at a desk in a studio.
Well, the correspondents are very much involved in the writing. You know, sometimes they'll pitch for themselves. They'll you know, Ronnie Chang will be like, "I have a good idea for Ronnie Chang," you know. And, you know, if Trevor likes it, you know, we'll do it. And then Ronnie would sit with two of us and write it up, you know, go through, like, you know, a bunch of revisions until it's, you know, ready to go on. So, you know, there's a bunch of different ways it can work. I mean, that's one example, is that a correspondent pitches for themselves. A lot of times, you know, a writer will pitch an idea with a correspondent in mind. Or sometimes what I do is I just say, you know, correspondent X, I just have an idea that would use a correspondent, you know, either out in the field or in a studio bit. Mm-hmm. And I just say, you can have any correspondent, just please do my idea. I'm desperate. I need something on the show, you know? So, like, that's another idea. And then, I mean, that's another way to do it. And then finally, you can just, a lot of times it's just kind of like an idea comes from Trevor, where it's just like, okay, we'll have Michael Costa or Desi, you know, do this idea. And that's another idea, you know, basically from the top, you know. A lot of times the idea for a correspondent will be generated that way.
Okay.
But, and also it's important to, another thing that I should say is that just like anybody who works at The Daily Show, whether a writer or not, is allowed to pitch. So sometimes it's like from a producer, you know, even a production assistant can pitch something.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it will be considered. So yeah, it's really, you know, like when I said, it's not competitive, it's like really a team effort.
Oh, that's lovely. It does from just as geographically removed a viewer as I can be. It seems mm-hmm. like it's got a real collegiate atmosphere and a very sort of united team element to it. So I'm glad that does seem to be the case, unless we're just reading this off talking points, of course. But it seems as though that is...
No, yeah, everything I say was not written by me, including the thing about having a wife and a cat. They just tell me to say that, so I look like more of a respectable writer.
That's why your camera's not on, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Man, if you saw what was going on here.
Well, you mentioned how long your tenure has been at The Daily Show. You started in 2013, of course, so under John and Trevor. What has been the biggest shifts you've seen? So first of all, overall, that you've seen from day one in 2013 to today, how has it differed? Coronavirus notwithstanding.
Oh, yeah. Let me see. Well... back then, the host was white. that would be the biggest difference. I mean, you know, it's weird. It's in certain ways, it's the same. And, you know, it's certain ways it's different. Like, you know, like it's weird. Like, it's, you know, obviously there's some big differences between, like, you know, John's style of comedy and Trevor's style of comedy, but mm-hmm. really it kind of feels like it's the differences between, like, before Trump and during Trump. That's sort of what it feels like to me. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, just around when it became the Trevor Show, it became the Trump Show. Mm. And so it's almost like I don't even know what it's hard to know what the Trevor Show would look like without Trump, because he's just like this, you know, magnet of, I mean, you know, he's the center of our universe. Not to say that we don't do other stuff that isn't around him. But certainly with COVID, there's more to cover. But it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's for me, like, since Trump, it's just been like different ways to, like, you know, people say it's like, oh, it's like, it must be so much easier with Trump in the White House. I'm like, well, actually, no, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, we get to eat candy for breakfast. And then after a while, you know, like 4 years later, I'm like, okay, well, what do I make a souffle out of this Tootsie Roll? I mean, we all know what a Tootsie Roll tastes like. You know, it's like too much of a what I guess used to be a good thing. I mean, I think in terms of like with working for John versus working for Trevor, I came in at the end of like when John was there. I had 2 years with John, and I feel like the process is very much like kind of set. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I came in as just, I mean, I felt like basically it's like, okay, well, it's the Daily Show. These guys know what they're doing. I'm just kind of there to help sling jokes, get a couple of jokes in, hopefully, you know, each show or something. But when Trevor took over, I mean, it was just a good opportunity to just sort of like help kind of contribute to kind of creating a new show. So that was just an exciting opportunity to be like, even though it was still the Daily Show, it was like a new thing. And I kind of felt like I was a little bit more part of, like, it felt a little bit more like it was like my show.
Yeah. And yeah. I remember some of the press around when he was taking over that there was a view that it would be a much more international focused show, and mm-hmm. and less American. Of course, the news eclipse happened, and you that laid waste to that.
Right.
Looking back at the time when you were sort of in the process of creating this brand new show, was it a total carte blanche, or were there, we're definitely keeping these elements, but these ones let's play around with?
There didn't seem to be any sort of rules. I mean, you know, I wasn't really, you know, I'm not like an executive producer or anything, but it did seem like it was pretty much kind of like, you know, we definitely wanted to try some new things, and we, you know, the first year was definitely like it looks pretty different than how things look now. I feel like now we're sort of in a groove, where back then it was, you know, when Trump first took over, it was just kind of like, you know, we're taking some elements of the old show. Like, just to give you a small example, like we used to do a lot more what we call chats, which are sort of like a correspondent, like in front of a green screen, pretending to be in a certain place, reporting quote unquote live.
Sure.
And, you know, we don't really do that as much now. A lot of green screen stuff, like it'll be more typically like a correspondent at a desk, you know, with Trevor, talking to Trevor, or maybe it'll be, you know, a correspondent in a sketch. Like, we do actual, like, sketches, as in, like, kind of, like, commercial parodies and just, like, standalone sketches. And we really didn't do, like, a lot of standalone sketches with John. It was, you know, it was all part of, like, the kind of, like, the news conceit. And now we'll kind of, like, kind of break that format and just be, like, you know, here's a sketch.
Yeah.
More, but yeah. So it's coming to its own more, I would say.
Totally. And yeah. You've mentioned in the past about how I'm not sure if it's because you prefer stand up or just a note something you've noticed about stand up as opposed to sketch or improv, is that it's less administrative. Which do you find sort of most at home with? Is it stand up? Is it sketch? Is it improv? Which sort of fits your? I tried to think of a term, and I couldn't. Not even a French term came to mind.
Over.
There you go. That'll do. Which I think means eggs, but that'll do.
Yeah, yeah. Which one fits my egg? I mean, yeah, I don't know. I'm certainly like, you know, doing, Like, it seems like sketch is like the most, like, it really, it comes down to like which one is the most based on like your life situation. Mm-hmm. Like, I would say actually, like, so I don't do a lot of improv, but probably the most practical form of comedy that I could do, short of just like sitting at home and writing something, which would be the most practical thing, is probably just doing improv, because you don't need to prepare for it at all. Mm-hmm. As long as you just have like a willing, you know, team, you can just go do it and go home. So that's great. But I, you know, I'm not like, I started improv, but I don't really do it, but like, you know, anymore. I, you know, I started in sketch, and, you know, the reason I got into sketch was because I love like Monty Python. So thank you to your nation for providing them.
You're welcome.
I don't know if you yourself had anything to do with that. I don't know if you're like Eric Idle's dad. I don't know how old you are.
For a lot of the outside scenes, it's mm-hmm. my body with John Cleese's face superimposed. So he's actually 4'1". It's just a lot of very
I would not have guessed that.
They blew a lot of the budget on that, which is why early Doctor Who looked so crap, because they just didn't have the scope anymore.
Right, that makes sense, yeah. But, you know, so I started in sketch, and so that was like, I always kind of wanted to be in a sketch group. So then, like, I, you know, for the first few years that I was in New York City, like, I was trying to, like, do sketch comedy, but, like, it was very hard to keep a group together, because, you know, it's like everyone, you know, would have like different opportunities. So groups that I was starting, you know, kept falling apart. The thing, talking about it now, maybe I was just sort of insufferable, and maybe that's why things didn't last. That could have been it. So then, like a few years in, I stopped doing sketch and started doing more stand up, and I found that like I found that I could get more reps in. Like, we'd have one show a month doing sketch, but like I could do like, you know, maybe a couple of shows in a night if I did stand up. So I kind of did that instead. Mm-hmm. And the main reason I wanted to do stand up is to show people that I could write a good joke. You know, so I could maybe hopefully land a writing job. And then I did land a writing job, but then I was like, well, I miss doing, you know, I still like doing stand up. And it kind of is, when you're a staff writer, it's great, you know, for, you know, obvious reasons, but, sure. People were like, are you still going to do stand up? And, I was like, yes, the people need to hear my jokes. No, but what I really was, thinking, which I mean, what the reason to do it is just that, like, when you write for like a late night show, most of your jokes, even if you're like super funny, like most of the jokes you write won't make it to air. You don't have like creative control, mm-hmm. like you do with like stand up. Mm-hmm. So yeah, stand up is a great way to just kind of be like, okay, well, this is exactly what I find funny, and here it is. This is what, you know, this is unfiltered me. And then the audience is like, well, we don't like that. And then that acts as a filter. And then the joke that I actually find funny, no one else does. And it's only funny in their head. So there is also a little bit of a compromise.
Sure.
But after that, that's, you know, that is the closest iteration of what I find funny.
By natural selection more than a solid gatekeeper.
Yeah, exactly, right, yeah, and it's true, like, maybe what I truly deeply find funny, no one else does. That, you know, that's kind of how my dad is. He's just kind of, well, like, he makes a joke and nobody finds it funny except him, so I have a little bit of him in me.
Do you remember your first joke, and is it one that you borrowed off your dad?
No, God, I don't. I have such an awful memory. I don't remember what my first joke was. Although I do have a memory of, like, you know, I had a friend, a next door neighbor, who like broke her leg, and then I remember like writing her like a get well card and thinking of a joke to put in it, and I was like, oh, this is gonna be a real whopper, and I showed it to her. And not only did she not get it, but her mother also didn't get it. And then her mother showed it to my parents, and they were like, we don't get it either. And then they asked me to explain it, and I was just like, you know what? Never mind. It's actually not worth explaining. I don't even know if I got it. And I've worked on my skills since then, but I am somebody who's like, I'm probably the person who most like will just toss out a joke that nobody understands. Hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah.
So an intentional surrealist.
Sometimes, yeah.
Oh. Why do you think Monty Python has such an effect on American audiences? Because as a Brit, it always seems surprising and very flattering when Americans name it as a comedy inspiration, because although we would never tell you, we always think of you as the more sort of elite, glamorous comedian older brother than us. So it's sort of flattering you've taken notice of us. But why do you think...
Really? Well, you guys are way older than us. That's very strange.
Well, that's true. Maybe it's more established younger brother. Whichever one Frasier was in Frasier and Niles, that. why Monty Python, why British comedy has found such a fandom in America?
I mean, I just speaking from my experience, I saw it and I was, you know, in like, I guess I was like 12, 13. And it was just very jarringly different from anything I had seen before. And I think the fact that it was so weird and there was just like, it was like, you know, it was basically like adults acting like children. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, the stuff that was so like aggressively stupid that it's just like, wow, you know? And I mean, I think that's why comedy always had like a fascination for me. It's just like, I always assumed that, you know, just based on like the adults around me, that I would just grow up and do some sort of boring job and then die. And then to like, you know, see people who are just acting like total idiots, like just dressing up in bad wigs, impersonating old women with like creaky voices and talking about how there's a penguin on the telly. I'm like, this is actually like, this is their like full-time job, is to do this. That's like, it made such a crazy impact on me. That I was just like transfixed. Mm-hmm. By it. Yeah, I don't know. Like, the thing is, yeah, around that time I also discovered, like, you know, Saturday Night Live, and that's, you know, it's you know, that was also like, I loved that too. Mm-hmm. But Monty Python was like you know, ethyl alcohol versus, you know, whiskey. It was just kind of like straight absurdity, and it was just like, oh wow, you know. And you know, I mean, I Monty Python was obviously the precursor to SNL, and mm-hmm. SNL is this, you know, institution to this day, but I'm always angry if people love SNL but don't know Monty Python.
Sure, yeah. What's always struck me about The Daily Show versus SNL is that whereas The Daily Show has championed and had cast members and writers from various regions around the world, in particular Britain, you've had quite a few of us over, it seems SNL has been very American and Canadian-centric with its cast, with its writing. Why do you think this is? Why do you think The Daily Show has sort of had more of a broader field?
That's a great question. You know, I don't really know. I mean, maybe it's just because, you know, it's hard to have a British person impersonating George W. Bush. I mean, it's not like impossible, you know what I mean? Like, but yeah, it is a great question. I'm honestly not sure. I don't know. I mean, I know that, you know, SNL gets a lot of people from like the Groundlings. Mm. I don't know. I guess I don't really know the the casting process of, you know, our show versus, like, you know, what the differences are. But yeah, you're right. I don't know. I guess our show has always been a little bit more interested in, you know, looking at other cultures. Like, yeah, maybe that's Jon Stewart's influence. I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't know. I wish I had a better answer. I'm sorry. I feel like I failed you.
It's a very solid answer. It is a.
Oh, okay, great.
It is.
I really want to pass this test.
You're doing great so far. It's the new citizenship test. So we just like to check up on you every 2 or 3 decades just to make sure.
Okay.
Mine is just a put-on accent. I'm actually from Delaware. You wrote for Hasan Minhaj for the White House Correspondents' Dinner. How is that process? How is it writing for a comedian performing in a room with a sort of, it seems like an almost 50-50 hostile, excited split?
Well, I mean, that's a good thing about writing for someone is that, you know, you don't have to deal with it once they're up there. Like, so, sure. You know, my, you know, general process is just think of, like, the most offensive jokes and, you know, let the performer, whether it's Trevor, John, or Hasan, just pick the ones that they think they can get away with saying. But yeah, I mean, you know, I was very flattered to be asked by Hasan. I think I was in Iceland actually when he asked me.
Oh wow!
I had really poor reception, I was just taking a little, week vacation, and I was like, oh wow, I'm gonna like write for a White House correspondent. That's really crazy, it was. You know, in the early days of Trump, the wrath of Trump. Mm. So it was a very exciting thing. And yeah, I mean, it was just sort of like, I mean, it's basically what I do every day, just trying to think of jokes in different areas. You know, we made fun of like CNN and also Trump, and we just tried to anticipate who would be there. You know, obviously we had a lot of news people and just kind of, you know, chat on them as much as possible. You know, it was exciting. It was a little different. It's interesting. It's like, you know, the process is the same. It's just kind of like thinking of jokes, but, you know, I mean, obviously you're trying to nail the person's voice, but it is, you know, in this field, like, it's weird. There's really is only so many topics, you know, you can make fun of, like, you know, Trump's weird, shitty marriage, or, you know, Eric Trump's weird face, you know, like, you know, there's really only so many punchlines that people can get on board with, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of, like, finding those targets. And I feel like I'm saying a really jaded comedy writer, but I'm like, you know what I mean? It's just kind of like you find the targets and then you look at the instrument, whether it's, you know, who you're writing for, and then you just kind of swing for the fences. I'm using I'm mixing a lot of metaphors here, but.
I know very little about sports, so this could be baseball for all I know.
Great, yeah. I don't know either. I'm really bad with sports, but people. A lot of times, you know, if somebody asks you to write for them, you just, you know, you know that they trust you to you already know they like your sensibility. So you just kind of do what you normally do. And generally with my thing, I tend, like, when I'm writing for someone, I tend to write kind of like mean or weird jokes. So hopefully they know that going in. Like, to give you a contrasting example, like, before I wrote for The Daily Show, I was hired to write for The Newlywed Game. Do you know what The Newlywed Game is?
Yes, I think it's called Mr. and Mrs. here, but I think it's the same concept.
Oh, yeah, that sounds way more British. So it's, you know, you ask newlyweds questions about their betrothed. And so anyway, they hired me and I was surprised, but they're like, you know, we know that you've written for, like, the Onion. You have a reputation as, like, a funny guy, funny writer, and we want to, like, make this show, The Newlywed Game, a little bit more subversive. And so I'm like, okay, I trust you if you guys think I'd be a good choice. And I wouldn't say it was a total disaster, but I don't think I was like the right fit, you know? I mean, I would just write these very weird questions. And also you'd have to write like 15 questions, like newlywed game questions in a day. And I don't know, I was not equipped for that job. So I just ended up, you know, writing really weird jokes like say you're a flesh eating bacteria, which part of your wife's body would you go through for a nice feast? And, you know, in that type of situation, maybe somebody's dark imagination is not the most useful tool. You know?
I heard you speak about that in Who's This Little Guy, which is amazing, by the way.
Thanks.
And I didn't know if that was real or not, that you actually wrote for that, but that's fantastic. Did you get any questions on, or were they solely sort of...
I did, yeah. I think what my crowning achievement, I hope I can remember it, but... you know, because they, you know, they like doing a lot of suggestive questions. So,
sure.
I think my the one that I was most proud of is like, if your husband's little country singer had a name, would it be Girth Brooks, Waylong Jennings, or Billy Ray Sideways? And Each of the women chose a different one. So one of those women had a husband with a very crooked penis, I guess. So I got that one on. I got a couple on, but there were people who were way better equipped to write, you know, game show questions than I was.
Sure, but they asked for subversive. You gave them subversive.
No, I did. That's the thing. They thought they wanted me. And then I just kind of went there and did my thing. And they're like, no, this is way too, this is not what they want. I feel like a lot of times people will just be like, we think we want something. And then they're, you know, maybe they want a little bit of it. Then when you're there from like 9 to 5 writing these weird questions about flesh-eating bacteria, you know, for like, you know, and it's like the people watching the Newlywed Game, or you know, generally they're like a lot of moms and stuff. They don't want to hear what I have to say, and I wouldn't either. So I don't know if I'm cut out for daytime television. I'm better suited for TV, like for when most people are asleep, you know.
Were Ellen's people not keen on flesh eating bacteria either?
No, not at all. And you know, I keep send them emails about flesh-eating bacteria all the time. They don't respond, so I don't know.
HR have, but...
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Do you... It's hard to find a segue for this next question, so we'll just come out with it straight. Favorite kids' book growing up?
Favorite kids' book? I liked Hungry Caterpillar, but I also... I still think Goodnight Moon is a very beautiful book.
We never had Goodnight Moon over here, to my knowledge. I know it's
oh, really? So you don't know what it is?
No, I can guess the plot from the title, but outside of that.
Yeah, it's an espionage thriller. it's
Jack Ryan.
Yeah, no, it's a nice, simple book. Yeah.
Lovely.
I also read, I remember The Velveteen Rabbit, which I feel like looking back, might have had some weird racial stuff in it. I don't know.
Really?
I feel like, I don't know. I'm probably going to cancel for saying, I you know, whatever. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, if anything should be cancelled, it sounds like The Velveteen Rabbit should be cancelled.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll get on that. Don't worry.
Please. Public service. No. what has been the best advice you've received, and what has been the worst advice you've received?
I mean, this wasn't given to me personally, but I remember when I was starting out in comedy, I read an interview with Bob Odenkirk, and he said to work with people who are better than you, you know, people who are who you feel can challenge you. So if like you're going to start a sketch group, like don't work with somebody who they're available. work with somebody who's like, you know, who can challenge you to be like a better writer or performer. Like when I was starting out, you know, I met a guy named Dan McCoy, who's currently my coworker at The Daily Show. And we were, you know, doing this sketch show, and I recognized him, you know, this is as, you know, somebody who's like very funny, solid writer. So I kind of pursued a working relationship with him, and we started, you know, doing sketch shows together. We were in a few of those sketch groups I had mentioned that kind of fell apart, but you know, we got to know each other and, you know, find each other funny. And so I think he has made me a better writer working with him, but also the added benefit is like he got hired, you know, to write for The Daily Show down the line, and then once he was in, he recommended me, and then I eventually wound up joining the staff. So it's like if you see somebody who you feel is kind of like talented and going places, definitely try to work with them, learn from them, you know, or, you know, even pitch your wagon to them.
Sure.
The worst advice, I guess, would probably be, you know, I guess floss every day, because I really feel like that's a waste of time. I don't know. Worst advice. I don't know. I guess probably somebody was like, you should try to be on SNL. I've gotten that one. And like, it's good advice, but it's like, you just kind of, you don't just go and be on SNL. I feel like people don't necessarily know how the biz works, you know, but it's...
Can't you just call up Lorne Michaels?
It's a little more complicated than that, yeah.
Sure. You've toured with both John Oliver and Bo Burnham, two comics pretty much on either side of a spectrum in terms of surrealism as opposed to satire. What has been your takeaway with seeing? Because you toured with John before he hosted in place of John when he went to film Rosewater. Is that right?
That was actually during.
Okay.
Yeah. He did a gig. Yeah, which looking back on it is like, wow, that's really crazy that he was hosting the show and also doing stand up at the same time. It was a while ago. I think either he was in the middle of doing it or no, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, it was, we did a stand up, you know, some gigs, but it was like the spring before. Yes, I think that was it. So. I'm sorry, what was your question again?
It was, I've forgotten it myself. there was one then there. Feel free to suggest an answer and we'll just edit a question
right. Oh, yeah. Well, I knew of John Oliver from watching him on the show, but I wasn't too familiar with his stand-up, and it was, you know, obviously super funny.
Mm-hmm.
And just to put it in context, I was not writing for the show yet. Okay. But I actually would be hired later that year. But oddly enough, it was like I had submitted to the show before I met John Oliver. So it was all basically a big coincidence that I had been like opening for John Oliver after submitting.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been like a couple of years into stand-up, but, you know, he had such like a... I learned a lot about him from watching him do stand-up. Like, I think when I started, I was just sort of like, I was kind of like somebody who, you know, had been on Twitter, and then from that started like adapting my Twitter jokes to stage. So I feel like he was really good at kind of like, I learned about like conversing with the audience. And like, we were in, you know, I remember we were in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and he would like, you know, he would gear all his jokes. He would be like, oh, you know, what's your problem, New Brunswick? You're not, you know what I mean? Like, it seemed like he was talking directly to a certain specific type of New Jersey residents, where I would just, you know, at that point, I would come on and just sort of do the dick jokes that I would do anywhere, you know what I mean? So he had a real, like, focused kind of presence with the audience that, you know, I learned a lot from. Mm-hmm. But he was, you know, in addition to that, he was just, like, such a great guy. And after watching me, he actually asked if I had ever submitted to The Daily Show.
Oh, wow.
And I said, actually, yes, I have. But I, at that point, I had, like, been put on a wait list for a year. So that happened, I think, like, kind of in the middle of that year that I was in limbo.
Sure. So a wait list to become a writer or a wait list to submit? Oh, no, you had submitted.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, I didn't know at the time. Basically, happened was the August before that in 2012, I had submitted. And, you know, they told me that, you know, John really liked my writing, but they're going to hire internally. But they'll keep me, you know, in mind for future openings, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. I'm sure you'd say that to all the prospective writers, you know. So I really did, you know, I mean, I dismissed it and kind of was like, oh, God. I was pretty hard on myself. I was like, oh, God, I shouldn't have put that cat joke in the submission. I knew they wouldn't like that. But it turns out it honestly was kind of like, it wasn't a rejection letter. It was really like, we actually really did like your stuff, but you know, we're hiring someone else. So it was kind of like a wait list for a year. And yeah, in that time I performed with John Oliver.
It's a lovely sequence of stepping stones to getting to the show then. It's sort of like a sort of gentle on-ramp over the course of the year to then feel up to speed and...
And during that time, I had applied to be a blogger for Tosh.0. I don't know if any of those words mean anything to you. Certainly nobody knows what a blogger is anymore, but I don't know if in Britain you know what Tosh.0 is. But
I do, but purely from nerdly researching age about 15, anything remotely connected to late night. So, I don't think it got a particularly large airing over here.
Well, then I won't go into it. But basically, I worked on that as a blogger. I worked at kind of like a, I did actually work at Comedy Central, but in a much lower type of position. You know, I actually was, the year waiting wasn't as bad as it could have been. I actually was able to work and stay afloat until I did get, you know, hired. So that worked out.
Yeah.
In case anybody was worried about me, any of your listeners were like, well, how did he survive while waiting? That was how.
They are expecting a day-by-day recount, a TikTok of the interim period. So that their minds are at rest now. This is good. Clearly, it'll panned out amazingly, and you got to be interviewed on Spilling the Beans, so that's naturally the highlight so far. My final question is... I normally ask why do we need stories, but I think given your career and tenure, why do we need political comedy?
Why do we need it? I don't know. I don't think we really do, honestly. I mean, you know, I think we did need it at a certain point, you know, now we've got Netflix. No, I mean, it's weird. I mean, I ask myself that too. I'm just like, you know, there are so many shows, and I think you probably wanted a inspirational answer for me. Like, we need it to. But I'm just like, I actually don't know why we need, because things really are so nuts that. Like, I'm like, oh, does anybody need us to do this? So it's funny because, like, when I write for this show, like, one thing I don't know is, like, who is watching it? How are they watching? I don't know if they're on their phone. I don't know if they're watching on TV. I don't know you know, what anybody's getting out of it. I'm just like, because you can just watch a Trump press conference and that's hilarious on its own. So my theory is just, you want, like, let's say that you're a person who lives alone and nobody ever talks to you. You're insufferable. Every sketch group that you start dissolves. Maybe you would need, like, a late night host to be like, just so you know, I also find this fucking crazy. That's my best guess. But personally, I think that, like, you know, stuff is so nuts that I'm like, I would totally understand if somebody's like, I'm not going to watch your late night show because everything is already hilarious. I would not begrudge that person.
Well, that is inspirationally nihilistic. thank you.
That being said, I do think that people should watch the Daily Show. I am very proud of what we do. And I'm not. And now I'm laughing while I say that, but I mean it.
I mean, sincerely, it does seem to act as a sort of, it's like the prism has flipped in around January 21st, 2017, and that it, whereas it seemed like political comedy before was taking a joke and taking something serious and making it funny, the Daily Show, at least to me as a viewer, seems to be providing excellent focusing on what is needed, what is cutting through waffle and bullshit and sort of finding the key points of what people need to take away. It is, for at least me, you're doing a phenomenal job and very much needed.
Oh, great. Well, I really appreciate that. That is nice to hear. Thank you for watching and thanks for... thanks for having me on your show. You're a great interviewer, and I had a lot of fun.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for coming on, good luck getting to November.
Thank you. Thanks.